morning, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Dobson, and I represent Mr. Turner. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. The issue here is whether the prosecutor committed reversible misconduct when she misstated the law as to the state's burden, misstated a material fact to the jury, wrongly told the jury that credibility determinations were an all-or-nothing proposition, called the defenses in this case a smear campaign, and said that defense counsel's legitimate arguments were, quote, insulting and offensive. I thought about going through each of these acts of misconduct, but unless the court wants to hear that, I think I should just go straight to flagrancy and prejudice. In this case, the full record shows that there was considerable animosity between defense counsel and the prosecutor, personal animosity. And even when there is acrimony, even when a prosecutor may feel goaded, she has a duty to seek a fair trial. It's not my client's responsibility or fault that these two attorneys have a personality conflict, and he had a right to a fair trial. And that did not happen here. The prosecutor in this case responded emotionally, and in that emotion, flagrantly disregarded her duty to seek a just verdict. Rather than taking the high road after defense argument, which we propose was legitimate here, the prosecutor rather than arguing about the laws and the facts, she struck at the heart of the defense case, and in a way that any prosecutor would know is unacceptable. Presumably, this prosecutor knew she had the burden to show usability. Presumably, she knew that what the record was and the responses by her state witnesses to her questions. Presumably, she knew that credibility is not an all-or-nothing proposition, and she must have known that she cannot divert the jurors from their duty to render a fair verdict by calling defense counsel's arguments insulting, offensive, referring to it as a smear campaign.
Yet, let's just stick with insulting and offensive, because okay, that's probably the most flagrant. Why no objection?
That's a good question here, Your Honor. And again, we have...
Is there a reason to believe that if there was an objection that it couldn't have remedied that situation?
I think, Your Honor, in this case, given the animosity, an objection would have fueled this even further. This would be that same defense counsel who apparently goaded.
So if the defense attorney had objected, it would have made the situation worse for the defendant.
I think in this case we could look at that.
So it's a tactical decision.
Now, I can't say that it is a tactical, but I'm saying what the reality is.
Can you conceive it as being a tactical decision? It seems as if you did.
No, I don't, and that's why we argue.
Well, you just told me, though, that to have objected would have made the situation worse.
Well, we're asking.
Can't we conceive of an attorney not objecting if he or she believes that it would make the situation worse?
We could conceive that. I don't think that's what has happened
in
here.
In your briefing, you point out that that the prosecutor was behaving in at best a borderline professional manner and was acting, these are my words, not yours, sort of petulantly and easily offended. And now you've, in argument, you've pointed out that this is the culmination of the way this trial took place. Is there any reason to believe that the jury wasn't aware of the relationship between the two?
Yes, there is, because it didn't happen in front of the jury. This was going on.
Well, the argument did, right?
This argument did, but what was going on leading up to this didn't happen in front of the jury. What happened in front of the jury, basically you have defense counsel making a legitimate argument and the prosecutor coming back and saying this is insulting and offensive,
right,
that they would make this argument.
And so we can't conceive of an attorney looking at the opponent and realizing, I don't think the opponent's doing very well with how the jury's looking at him right now. I don't want to fuel the flames by objecting. I'm just going to let her hang herself with this ridiculous behavior?
We might possibly be able to conceive that. However, the defense counsel sat on his hands in several situations where
I'm talking about this one. And in fact, there was an acquittal on one of the counts. So the jury didn't believe everything that the prosecutor was arguing.
Well, what's interesting was that account relied only on Simmerly's testimony, not Thorson's. And
but the prosecutor argued for a conviction on that count.
Yes.
The jury did not reward the prosecutor with a conviction.
No, but in this case, where the misconduct went was to the heart of the theft of an access device. The burden problem, the misrepresentation of the facts go right into that. And that was the argument that she referred to as offensive and insulting. And going back to the question of...
If we can conceive of it as ultimately being tactical, mm-hmm. Is there anything left?
Yes, because that's one act out of several where defense counsel did not object. So I think the idea that he tactically did not object to this one is stretching the record, because he's sitting there throughout the entire rebuttal where the prosecutor is disavowing a burden that is obviously the state's burden and is misrepresenting facts.
Yeah, but can't we conceive of a lawyer sitting there listening to rebuttal argument after having already, because this primarily these things were in rebuttal, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So was this a male or a female defense attorney who gave closing argument?
I believe it's male.
Okay, so then he's already given his closing. Let's assume he's like most lawyers, so he thinks he did pretty well. Then he's looking at the jury, and he's correctly perceiving that at least some of this is going well from their body language. And we know that's a correct perception because there was an acquittal. Why isn't it all makes sense that he just let the prosecutor act foolishly, thinking he might win it all, but it looks like he's winning some of it?
Again, I will just, if I can answer that question.
Sure.
Again, it stretches the imagination that a defense counsel will sit there and let the state say that it doesn't have a burden it has. And so to sit there through all of this stretches the imagination, and that would be my answer to that.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Carol Laverne, representing the state. The state's basic response here is that the defendant's extravagant outrage to this prosecutor's argument is excessive to what the record would support. It's true that the prosecutor rather inartfully argued a couple of things, and those events amply pointed out.
There's nothing inartful about the offensive, whatever it was, and insulting and offensive. It seems to me your best argument is that this prosecutor was so unprofessional and ridiculous that in the course of giving away one of the counts, that defense counsel decided to just sit there and let the prosecutor hang him or herself with their bad behavior.
And that's a
tactic that we can conceive. It's not very I don't know what to say. It's nothing to be proud of from the part of the state. But it seems like that's the best argument you've got, that your representative was so unprofessional that the best tactic for the opposing counsel to take was to sit back and just let him behave so poorly.
I would argue that if you read the argument in its totality, that it was not that unprofessional. She said a couple of things that were incorrect, but in general, she had it right. She argued the law. She made it.
Tell me about insulting and offensive. How is that in? How is that those words, when used to characterize another professional's argument, where you're saying you're taking personal offense to that? How's that ever proper?
It may not be
proper. Especially in rebuttal.
But he didn't. The person doing the rebuttal argument has a little more leeway on rebuttal than in the direct closing. But there was no objection, which means.
Well, no. I'm not talking about that they didn't save you from yourself, you being your party. That's, I don't care about that. My question to you is, in what universe is accused, making the accusation that a lawyer's argument is insulting and offensive to you, proper professional behavior?
I'm not arguing that it is proper professional behavior. I'm arguing it's not reversible behavior in this case. The defense didn't object, which tends to cause you to believe that they did not find it that offensive.
I don't think that's a necessary inference. I read this, and the inference I get is they thought it was so offensive that it might benefit them with the jury, and they actually got an acquittal on one of the counts.
That seems to
support the latter inference.
Which leads to the argument that the jury was not influenced by this unprofessionalism, so that it rendered an unfair verdict.
It leads to a conceivable inference that it was a tactic to let the prosecutor behave so poorly.
Well, we have an adversarial system. A jury expects that. I'm not clear what appellant's counsel is referring to when she said that what happened outside the presence of the jury leads to this conclusion that there was personal animosity there. I know both of these attorneys, and I'm not aware of any personal animosity there, and I did not find that in the record. It's just that the prosecutor was irritated by that particular argument that defense counsel made, and she should not have used the words offensive and whatever the other word was, insulting. But in the total context of this trial, when you look at it, can you say that this was an unfair verdict? And we don't expect our attorneys to be perfect. There's never been a perfect trial. I've been doing appellate work for the better part of 9 or 10 years. I've never seen a perfect trial. When you have an adversary system and you have people arguing, they're going to have personal feelings about it. But the jury is properly instructed. There's been no challenge to the jury instructions. The prosecutor used inappropriate language. But if you look at some of the other cases where the court has found that it was not sufficiently prejudicial to reverse, the Lindsay case out of Division II is probably the most jaw-droppingly bad instances of both the defense counsel and the prosecutor behaving childishly. And even there, the court listed a number of things worse than this, I argue, that would not have in themselves been reversible. So I'm not arguing that what the prosecutor did was correct or was professional. I'm arguing it in the context of this trial. It's not reversible error, because there is nothing that leads to the conclusion that the defendant got an unfair trial. Obviously, the jury was not particularly swayed by the argument that it had to believe all or nothing of Mr. Simmerly's testimony, and really, in context, that's not what she meant to say. She was arguing that you can't credibly claim everything that you say about me that's good is true and everything you say about me that's bad is untrue. She just worded it in a phrase that she should not have done. But in the entire context of this trial, what was the harm to Mr. Simmerly? They could not have convicted solely on Mr. Simmerly's testimony. And I think what you have to look at, the evidence shows that the telephone was in that car. There was no question that the stolen property was in that car. Everybody said there was no other person who had the opportunity to put that property in the car except Mr. Turner. The purse didn't hit the ground until Simmerly was already in the car and did not get back out. Ms. Satak was getting in on the other side of the car. Mr. Turner got into the front passenger seat, started to get back out, and then got back in. So if that purse got from the pavement into the car, nobody but Mr. Turner did it. And so no matter what
this isn't an insufficiency case. Nobody's arguing that evidence is insufficient.
But it goes to show that this unprofessional statement by the prosecutor did not make the trial unfair. You do not reverse simply because of prosecutorial misconduct unless there's prejudice. And you cannot show that there's any prejudice here because even without that statement, the evidence was very clear that he would have been convicted of that charge.
Well, is there any reason to believe, I mean, more to the point, is there any reason to believe that if there had been an objection that the trial judge would have interjected him or herself into the scrum?
True. And I cannot believe that the prosecutor, if there had been an objection and the trial court sustained that, I can't imagine that the prosecutor would have ignored that, as defense counsel argued in their brief, or appellant's counsel argued in the brief, and simply gone on and continued to say things like that. No prosecuting attorney is going to do that. If the court had said, no, that's not correct, jury, read your instructions, or the law is this.
So the question then becomes, is the absence of an objection, is that an indicia of ineffective representation, or can it be explained by a conceivable tactic?
I think it could be explained as a tactic.
I think it can, too. I think it can be explained by the tactic is the other lawyer's making a fool of themselves, and I'm looking at the jury, and I think that at least part of this is going well for me.
And that's, you know.
And so I don't want to stand up and play into it by objecting when I'm accused of being mean to him or her.
And attorneys do watch the jury during their opposing counsel's argument, and that is possible. I'd also argue that it's possible that nobody in the courtroom interpreted the prosecutor's statements in quite the way that they came out. We don't have the benefit of facial expressions, hand gestures. That particular prosecutor uses
for an ineffective assistant. I mean, these are the multi-level claims that we see. It was wrong. We didn't object. It couldn't have been saved by an instruction, and if it could have, it's ineffective to not have objected. So that's the train we've got here. But to resolve the ineffective assistance claim, we don't have to know what subjectively is in the lawyer's mind, right? It's an objective standard. We just have to look and see if there's anything that we can conceive of that would explain it.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Three minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to address what you were just saying. If I'm understanding what the court is suggesting is that when prosecutorial misconduct is so bad that and defense counsel doesn't object, you'll just assume that it was tactical.
If you can conceive of that,
that
absolutely.
Really insulates particularly bad. If there's a combination where we have defense counsel who's not on the ball and you have prosecutorial misconduct that is outrageous, then there's no relief for this client who's sitting there.
Now, your argument on that is with Strickland.
Well,
because the objective standard starts in Strickland, and for 35 years the law has been it's not a matter of what's subjectively in the actual advocate's mind because it's an objective standard. If there's a conceivable explanation, then it doesn't fall below the standards of professional conduct. Here we have someone who you yourself started out telling me was behaving ridiculously. That's the prosecutor. We have a result where one of the counts is an acquittal.
It has to be a legitimate tactical.
It resulted in an acquittal. It's a legitimate tactic.
It didn't result
the,
in an acquittal.
The counsel was representing them on all charges.
There were two.
It's not in effect. Even if counsel, I'll go you one further. Even if counsel thought, I may only be benefiting on this one count and not benefiting on the other, that still can't be ineffective assistance because you're representing on both charges, and attorneys all the time have to make decisions that might benefit one count and not the other. So here, objectively, what we know is there was an acquittal on one count. We also know that we had a prosecutor that was behaving ridiculously. why isn't it conceivable that that was perceived by trial counsel and they thought this is going pretty well? I'm not. You yourself told me counsel didn't want to stand up and object and make it worse.
Your Honor, what I am trying to put out is that there was an acquittal based on the malicious mischief, the destroying of the phone. That was a completely different question where all this ineffective was going on was on the question of whether those were usable, those credit cards were able to be used to access something of value. And that was where all this was, and that's where the equivalent.
Yeah, and there was happened. And there was evidence. You don't. You yourself don't claim that there wasn't sufficient evidence. There was. She canceled the credit cards.
Your Honor, if we take your line of argument all the way through, then there should have been acquittal on both. That what we have is this ridiculous prosecutor and they're banking on that. Well, then we would see it on both counts, and that didn't happen. In this case, there's a lot of fiction being created here, but in the end, may I finish my point? The prosecutorial misconduct doesn't rise or fall on whether this was a legitimate trial tactic or not. It's flagrant, it was flagrant, it was prejudicial, and we ask for reversal.
Thank you both very much. That concludes our